Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Michael B. This is Mike's Hot Seat, Left is Never Right on Higher Truth Radio, coming to you live on July 19th, 2016, 10:01 Central Time from the North Dallas Metroplex in the Lone Star State of Texas. So, yesterday we had day one of the Republican National Convention, and it looks like nobody got shot or stabbed, so that's a good thing. I wake up this morning and I go on Facebook, and the main theme seems to be Melania Trump's speech and how she stole most of it from Michelle Obama. And, you know, look, true or false, is it really, who cares? Who cares, all right? I think that we have better things to worry about, and quite frankly, day one of the RNC must have went very well, because if the leftists only have Melania Trump's plagiarized speech to cry about, I think it was a really good night instead of tackling the real issues, which, look, honestly, if you use reason, logic, and common sense, you really can't choose Hillary's platform over Donald Trump's. You just can't do it. So I think it was very indicative of the success last night that the RNC obviously had. If all the libtards can do is go after Melania Trump's speech. And as I wrote on Facebook yesterday, you know, they have been knocking Melania's accent over the last several months, the fact that she's an immigrant, which to me is horrifying and astonishing, because are we not a nation of immigrants? And, you know, you hear that all the time. And isn't it true that the left is the champion of Muslim refugees coming here, and they're the champions of keeping the borders open to bring the South Americans and the Mexicans over here? And matter of fact, they don't even believe that they should mandatorily be made to speak English. And yet, they criticize Melania Trump. Now, I wonder if they would do the same thing if she was Spanish. Or if she was black, would they, you know, let's say she had a Nigerian accent, would they be mocking her then the way they are now? And I really wonder. I don't think they would. So, I mean, you want to talk about blatant racism. Who are really the racists here, ladies and gentlemen? It's clear. It is clear who has been the racist, who are the racists. And they claim to be the champions of the minorities and of the immigrants, but they really aren't. And so we'll see what happens in day two. We've been talking about the attack on guns, obviously, with the cop shooting. And the narrative is, you know, it's not a Muslim issue. It's not a black issue, although I have very easily shown through FBI statistics, through the Center of Disease Control statistics, Harvard studies, what truly is the problem here? But they want to use the narrative that it's a gun issue. Well, this gun confiscation deal is not new. And it's interesting. Every time I do research on the neo-Marxist left-wing democratic agenda, it always takes me to the 1960s. And it's done it again. In 1961, the Department of State publication, Bureau of Public Affairs, wrote a United States program for the general and complete disarmament in a peaceful world. Now, this is a very dry read, so I'm not going to waste your time with that. It started with the reduction of nuclear weapons. It started with the, and this is all proposed at the time, the delivery methods to be reduced. And finally, basically, giving the United Nations total authority on what type of weapons could be manufactured. And what this does, or they want to do this, is that they want to really suspend not just the Second Amendment, but the Constitution in total. And this is what we've been talking about. Those that have been raising the alarm about a new world order, about a one world government, and that the United Nations is used as a filter for that. And, you know, this is not tinfoil hat wearing. These statements are in the documents. They think that they're going to create a peaceful, loving utopia. See, that's the front, which is an impossibility. While we are human beings, we will always have good versus evil. We're always going to have crime. We're always going to have poverty. Now, we can take the right steps to reduce those things, but the left isn't doing it. And I think it is fair to say that as our government, particularly in the United States, becomes more radical, socialist, neo-Marxist, the more chaos that is being brought to us. And so this entire disarmament program is to transfer, and speaking for the United States, transferring our constitutional sovereignty over to the United Nations. And of course, the plan is to have every nation under the UN umbrella. But quite frankly, when you put absolute power into one entity, does it not corrupt absolutely? And this is why we have the story in Genesis of the Tower of Babel that, you know, man at that time wanted to reach to the heavens. And Jehovah, Yahweh, saw that man was getting too powerful and they were going to become like gods, if you will. And, you know, I wrestled with that parable for almost 20 years. Why wouldn't God want us to have such power? Why wouldn't God want us to be like gods? And it was only recently that it finally clicked that, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely, that we as human beings cannot handle such godly power. So in the allegory, God, as I know, those of us that have read the Bible, confused the languages and man scattered throughout the world. And we see that if you take it a step further, nationalism and patriotism of your country, looking out for your countrymen, doing what's right for your country, competition, Real competition, not these fake free trade things that we have, but real competition and protection of your people and your sovereignty, that equals success. The other way of doing things, farming out your quality jobs, diluting your economy, diluting your sovereignty, and handing it over to a funnel foreign entity, weakens you as a nation, and it causes economic breakdown, moral breakdown, social breakdown, educational breakdown, all of it. Because you will never be able to trust that a foreign entity has your best interest at heart, and we're seeing this. So this disarmament stuff goes all the way back to 1961. And I talked about the Communist Manifesto reaching the United States in 1963. I've gone over that. We've talked about transhumanism reaching the United States in the 1960s. The sexual revolution, bringing back paganism, bringing back earth worship, flower children, all of that stuff coming from the 1960s. Assassinating the last real president, John F. Kennedy, in 1963. He pulled a fast one on his masters, if you will. They figured, you know, his father's part of the mob. They strong evidence shows that the election was rigged. Nixon really should have won in 1960, and they thought that they had a puppet. And John F. Kennedy threw them a curveball, and they shot him. And ladies and gentlemen, I don't know how we cannot say it's been downhill ever since. The United States of America must break away from the United Nations. We have the Trans-Pacific Agreement, which is going to put us into the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And again, that also is handing over American sovereign economic power to a foreign entity. And not only that, it's putting our Constitution, it's nullifying it and putting our destiny into the hands of a few corporations. We must not allow this to happen. And the only one talking about not getting into the TPP is Donald J. Trump. And if Trump turns out to be a shill, a fake, ladies and gentlemen, we don't know that. But we know for sure where Hillary Clinton stands. She must be stopped. Again, it's going to come down to, as it's looking, the same four swing states are going to decide this election. Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, and Florida. And it doesn't seem to me that Ohio, once again, is going to be a friend to its right for this country. Ohio elected Barack Obama twice. They elected a rhino liberal in disguise governor in John Kasich, who was in favor of NAFTA, which decimated Ohio's economy in the early 21st century. Decimated it. Barack Obama threatened to bankrupt the coal industry, and he was close. And yet Ohio voted for him. Hillary Clinton has pledged to finalize Obama's dream of bankrupting the coal industry in total. And this will have devastating effects on our economy. And I just don't get it. I'm going to play this clip. It's only 45 seconds. These are Hillary Clinton's own words.
Example, I'm the only candidate which has a policy about how to bring economic opportunity using clean, renewable energy as the key into coal country. Because we're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business. Right, Tim? And we're going to make it clear that we don't want to forget those people. Those people labored in those mines for generations, losing their health, often losing their lives, to turn on our lights and power our factories. Now we've got to move away from coal and all the other fossil fuels. But I don't want to move away from the people who did the best they could to produce the energy that we relied on. So whether it's coal country or Indian country.
So she's going to bankrupt the coal industry. And then she's going to say, oh, but we're going to take care of them. No, you're not. Government cannot force industry change. That has to be done through the private market. The government, they are not the innovators. The private sectors are. So she's going to continue to decimate the coal industry. And John Kasich is not thinking about what's best for his state. He's been silent when it comes to endorsing Donald Trump. It is time to unify. So I want to continue with the disarmament and what socialism and gun confiscation looks like. I want to key in on Venezuela. Venezuela has more oil reserves than Saudi Arabia. This country should be one of the richest countries in the world. Most of their citizens should be fat and happy. Venezuela should be a tourist attraction, a flourishing, independent, sovereign nation, an economic tour de force. Instead, it is crumbling to its core. And that's because of socialism. In crime-swamped Venezuela, cops are the target. This is coming from the Miami Herald, and there were many sources on this. There was Infowars.com, that you people call a tinfoil hat-wearing joke. Breitbart, there has been, and I'm just saying off the top of my head here. But I took it from the Miami Herald. You all know that's a real newspaper, but you know everybody else is fake. So here are the highlights. This is coming from November 2015. More than 120 officers have been killed this year, that's 2015, in Caracas. Authorities say they're being targeted for their weapons. Gang members say everything from grenades to machine guns are available for a price. Do you understand that? They're robbing and killing cops so they can sell grenades and machine guns on the black market, and of course these gang members use them for territorial and monetary gain. And of course Hillary Clinton, and you know, I'm going to grab that clip one day and play it, said gangs are like family. Gang violence in America makes up most of the violence overall in America, and here it is in Venezuela. A gang member in Caracas, Venezuela, shows off a pistol and bulletproof jacket he says his associates took from the body of an assassinated policeman. Some 124 police have been murdered in Caracas in 2015, many of them for their service weapons. This is coming from Jim Weiss, Miami Herald. The gang leader emerges from a darkened bedroom holding two grim trophies, a bulletproof vest and a 9mm handgun, both taken off a murdered policeman. Venezuela has long been synonymous with bloodshed. The country has the second highest homicide rate in the world after Honduras, and violence is commonplace that only the most spectacular of crimes, murders of celebrities at funerals and in broad daylight, seem to make the news. Increasingly, however, it's the police who are under fire. In recent weeks, and again of 2015, gangs have ambushed police stations with hand grenades and machine guns. Patrolmen are being hunted for their motorcycles, body armor, and weapons. So far this year, 125 law enforcement officials have been murdered in Greater Caracas alone. If that same rate held in the United States, it would be the equivalent, and this is staggering, of 6,572 police murders. Instead, there have been 33 shooting deaths of U.S. officers, and that was 2015. Enrique, who runs a gang of 15 hardened drug dealers, arms traffickers, thieves, and kidnappers, agreed to talk to the Miami Herald. And I lost it. This is skipped up. All right, here we go. Under the condition of anonymity, showing off the Glock pistol that he claims his gang took from an officer a month ago, he said the authorities are outgunned. The police want to wage war against us, but they can't. All weapons are meaner. In theory, guns are highly regulated. Now watch this. Here we go. Are highly regulated in Venezuela. And the government occasionally engages in sweeps to keep them off the streets. Who are they really sweeping, ladies and gentlemen? They're sweeping legal gun owners. Matter of fact, I don't think you can own a gun. I think Venezuela is one of those countries, again, that has strict, strict gun laws, like Mexico. And how is that working out? So, doing these sweeps, you know, you got to wonder who's being swept. But Enrique said cash-strapped cops, oh, this is great, and military officials will supply the gangs with anything they want. See, why are cops and military officials giving these gangs weapons to shoot themselves? And when I mean themselves, I'm talking about the cops and the military. Why are they doing that? I'm going to tell you why. Venezuela's socialist economy is dead. They are having rampant food shortages. So what these cops and the military people are doing, they're so desperate for money. I know it's in their mindset. Live and eat for today in case I may die tomorrow, but I need to worry about today, because tomorrow may never come. An AR-15, AK-47, or other machine gun might go for 1.2 million bolivares, or about $1,700 if bought with black market dollars. A hand grenade runs about $71. The police are very corrupt, Enrique said. They don't earn anything, and so, to make a little more money, they will sell you their guns or ammunition. If it wasn't for the police, we wouldn't have weapons. We wouldn't have anything. I mean, this is huge. And you people want to put Hillary Clinton in office that wants to just continue the stampede by people that can't work, don't understand English, don't want to understand English, don't want to assimilate to the American way of life, we're going to be in the same boat. We are going to look like Venezuela if we do not stop the onslaught of this neo-Marxist movement that has been damaging this country for at least 50 years. In Venezuela, police corruption might be as much about survival, as I just said, as it is profit. Enrique admitted that the officer they killed in October was targeted because he'd arrested a gang member and then refused a bribe to let him go. He didn't take the money, and a guy is still in jail, so he had to die, Enrique explained. It was just revenge. Jesus Eduardo Lama is the assistant director of the 1,658-strong police force of Miranda State. which includes part of Greater Caracas. Of police killed this year, six have been his officers. While he concedes there may be some bad apples within the National Police Force, the vast majority of officers are honest, underpaid, and hardworking. See, this guy even admits that his officers are underpaid and hardworking, which really in reality means overworked. An entry-level policeman in Miranda State makes 386,000 bolivares a year in salary and benefits. If she were forced to exchange that cash for dollars on the street, it would be 550 U.S. dollars a year. Any of his men and women could probably make more doing something else, he said, but they're passionate about their jobs. Yeah, well, you know, you give them A for effort, but you give them a D for reality. To be a policeman in this country right now requires a great deal of heroism. The criminals are far better armed than we are. They have access to weapons we're not even authorized to carry. You understand that, ladies and gentlemen? This is the road that we're headed. And while this is happening, our Second Amendment rights to protecting our families, to protecting our children, to protecting our businesses, to protecting our homes is being attacked and attacked to disarm you. So we're going to be in the same boat. So if you think the police are being hunted now, just wait. Just wait until we're hungry. We're really, really hungry. And police start selling off their ammunition and weapons to eat. Live for today, because tomorrow may never come. Now, I want to move on to, we have a policy in this country. And the policy is to capture and arrest illegal aliens and then deport them back to their country. And of course, one would never think that, you know, they're going to come back and do it all over again. No, see, they're going to see the light. They're going to see what they did was wrong. They're going to go back to their country free of punishment from us, and they're going to be good people, and they're never going to come back and do it. Well, we have a case here in Oregon where an illegal immigrant who slaughtered three people had been deported not once, not twice, but six times. A Mexican national charged with aggravated murder in the shooting deaths of three people at a rural Oregon blueberry farm had been deported six times, most recently in 2013, according to U.S. and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. Bonifacio Osguera Gonzalez, 29 years old, has no significant prior criminal convictions, but ICE asked Oregon authorities to turn him over to them if he's released from custody in the current case, the agency said in a statement to the Associated Press. Gonzalez pleaded not guilty to three counts of aggravated murder and one count of attempted murder Tuesday in Marion County Superior Court. His attorney, Deborah Berdzik, did not immediately return a call seeking comments. Two men who lived at the blueberry farm in the Willamette Valley town of Woodburn in northwestern Oregon died at the scene of Monday's shooting. The third victim, the girlfriend of another resident who was not at home at the time, was pronounced dead at a hospital. A third man was seriously wounded but survived and is able to speak with investigators. Many of these criminals are flooding the United States from Mexico. As Donald Trump has said, they are murderers and agents for their narco bosses in Mexico. you would like to know mentality and ideologies of the Mexican drug cartels, there's a documentary called Hell Across the Border. And I think maybe I'm going to look at that one day. The compelling and eye-opening documentary makes it impossible to deny the 250,000 people and rising that have been butchered. This is a Holocaust that dwarfs anything ISIS ever produced, all because millions in the Americas chose to hate the Christian heritage, opting instead to adhere to the paganism of Mesoamerica. Wow, I really am going to watch this. This individual has been deported 6 times. Mayors in mostly highly liberal cities in the United States of America have created unconstitutional and illegal sanctuary cities for these individuals. This is a huge problem. We must have a president who at least states he's going to be tough on illegal immigration. And as far as I'm concerned, deporting criminals is not the answer. They come back and they do it again and again and again. These people do not deserve the due process under the Fourth Amendment as a U.S. citizen does. They should be treated as a military combatant. They are committing terrorism and murder in our country. They should go before a military tribunal, and when they are found guilty, I'm sure the penalty under the military banner is far, far harsher than our civilian courts. To me, that is the way to go. If an American citizen commits a crime in Mexico, he will not be allowed to just cross the border and go home. His penalty is harsh. And that's the way it is throughout most of the world, except where? The United States of America and now Western Europe. And we see the damages. I'm going to stop here today, and I'm going to open up talking about Europe's immigration policy, which has caused mass raping across the continent. I do want to close with, and this is, well, it's roughly 13 minutes. It's Hillary Clinton, 13 minutes of Hillary's lies. My name is Michael B. This is Higher Truth Radio, Seeking Higher Truth on Facebook. Mike Totsi, Left is Never Right, Knocking Out the New World Order, One Libtard at a Time. 13 minutes of Hillary.
You're against same-sex marriage. Now you're for it. You defended President Obama's immigration policies. Now you say they're too harsh. You supported his trade deal dozens of times. You even called it the gold standard. Now, suddenly, last week, you're against it. Will you say anything to get elected?
Well, actually, I have been very consistent over the course of my entire life. I have always fought for the same values and principles.
Do you think New York State should recognize gay marriage?
No.
No. Okay.
I believe that marriage is not just a bond, but a sacred bond between a man and a woman.
I have not supported same-sex marriage. I have supported civil partnerships and contractual relationships.
I support marriage for lesbian and gay couples. I support it personally and as a matter of policy and law.
So you're saying your opinion on gay marriage changed, or you changed your mind?
I have to say, I think you are being very persistent, but you are playing with my words and playing with what is such an
important
issue.
I'm just trying to clarify
issue.
So I can understand.
No, I don't think you are trying to clarify. I think you're trying to say that, you know, I used to be opposed and now I'm in favor and I did it for political reasons. And that's just flat wrong. So let me just state what I feel like you are implying and repudiate it. I have a strong record. I have a great commitment to this issue, and I am proud of what I've done and the progress we're making.
Yeah, I'm saying, I'm sorry, I just want to clarify what I was saying. No, I was saying that you maybe really believed this all along, but, you know, believed in gay marriage all along, but felt for political reasons America wasn't ready yet and you couldn't say it. That's what I was thinking.
No, that is not true.
It really is great how long you've supported gay marriage.
Yeah. I could have supported it sooner.
Well, you did it pretty soon.
Yeah. Could have been sooner.
Fair point.
Just in July, New Hampshire, you told the crowd you, quote, take a backseat to no one when it comes to progressive values.
I take a backseat to no one when you look at my record and standing up and fighting for progressive values.
Last month in Ohio, you said you plead guilty to, quote, being kind of moderate and center. Do you change your political identity based on who you're talking to?
No. I think that, like most people that I know, I have a range of views, but they are rooted in my values and my experience.
You know, I get accused of being kind of moderate and center. I plead guilty.
Just for the record, are you a progressive or are you a moderate?
I'm a progressive.
Going through the emails, there were over 60,000 in total sent and received. About half were work-related and went to the State Department, and about half were personal, that were not in any way related to my work.
When you speak to the public, you say, I turned over everything. That's, for the most part, a direct quote. When you talk to the public, you say, I turned over everything.
90 to 95% of my work-related emails were in the state system. If they wanted to see them, they would certainly have been able to do so.
You know what? That is maybe the 10th time you have cited that figure today.
It is.
And I have not heard anyone other than you ever cite that figure. Who told you that 90 to 95% of your emails were in the State Department system? Who told you that?
We learned that from the State Department in their analysis of the emails that were already on the system.
The Inspector General report found that less than 1% of State Department emails, record emails, were captured. So they give a number of less than 1%, and you give a number of 90%.
I have absolute confidence that everything that could be in any way connected to work is now in the possession of the State Department.
This pile represents the emails that you sent or received about Libya in 2011, from February through December of 2011. This pile represents the emails you sent or received from early 2012 until the day of the attack. There are 795 emails in this pile. We've counted them. There are 67 emails in this pile in 2012. And I'm troubled by what I see here. I can only conclude by your own records that there was a lack of interest in Libya in 2012.
The server contains personal communications from my husband and me.
The only time I got on the internet, I did two emails. And I ordered Christmas presents from a reservation. Otherwise, I found people said embarrassing things on emails. I didn't want to be one of them.
I mean, and how many angels dance on the head of a pin? I have really nothing to, how do you answer that?
I represented Wall Street as a senator from New York, and I went to Wall Street in December of 2007, before the big crash that we had, and I basically said, cut it out. Quit foreclosing on homes. Quit engaging in these kinds of speculative behaviors.
Now, who's exactly to blame for the housing crisis? I think there's plenty of blame to go around. Home buyers who paid extra fees to avoid documenting their income should have known they were getting in over their heads.
Of course we have to deal with the problem that the banks are still too big to fail. We can never let the American taxpayer and middle-class families ever have to bail out the kind of speculative behavior that we saw. But we also have to worry about some of the other players. AIG, a big insurance company. Lehman Brothers, an investment bank. There's this whole area called shadow banking. That's where the experts tell me the next potential problem could come from. So I'm with both Senator Sanders and Governor O'Malley in putting a lot of attention onto the banks. And the plan that I have put forward would actually empower regulators to break up big banks. I represented New York, and I represented New York on 9/11. When we were attacked, where were we attacked? We were attacked in downtown Manhattan, where Wall Street is. I did spend a whole lot of time and effort helping them rebuild. That was good for New York, it was good for the economy, and it was a way to rebuke the terrorists who had attacked our country.
9/11 was bad.
I agree with that.
Time and time again, you hear one thing in speeches, and then you see a campaign that has the worst kind of tactics, reminiscent of the same sort of Republican attacks on Democrats. Well, I am here to say that it is not only wrong, but it is undermining core Democratic principles. Since when do Democrats attack one another on universal health care?
I've looked at the legislation that Senator Sanders has proposed, and basically he does eliminate the Affordable Care Act, eliminates private insurance, eliminates Medicare, eliminates Medicaid, TRICARE, Children's Health Insurance Program.
Just because Senator Obama chose not to present a universal health care plan does not give him the right to attack me because I did. So let's have a real campaign. Enough with the speeches and the big rallies and then using tactics that are right out of Karl Rove's playbook. This is wrong, and every Democrat should be outraged.
The Democratic Party in the United States worked since Harry Truman to get the Affordable Care Act passed.
So shame on you, Barack Obama. It is time you ran a campaign consistent with your messages in public.
Hillary Clinton's attempt to tout her foreign policy experience hounded her again on the campaign trail today.
I made a mistake in describing it.
She claimed she misspoke last week and was sleep deprived when she described landing under sniper fire in Tuzla, Bosnia, something that didn't happen. But CBS News has found several times in the past few months when Senator Clinton used the Bosnia trip to try to show her international experience. December in Iowa.
You know, we landed in one of those corkscrew landings and ran out because they said there might be sniper fire. I don't remember anybody offering me tea on the tarmac when that was happening.
Then in February.
The welcoming ceremony had to be moved inside because of sniper fire.
And last week.
I remember landing under sniper fire. We basically were told to run to our cars. Now that is what happened.
There's some differing accounts of your trip to Bosnia, and I'm wondering if you can clarify. I know you recall ducking under sniper fire, and Sinbad, in his account, who's on the trip, he said that the most dangerous part was remembering where he was going to eat next.
He's a comedian, you know, Jeff.
So you actually recall, you know, hearing gunfire, and were you
when we were flying into Bosnia, we came in an evasive maneuver. There was no greeting ceremony, and we basically were told to run to our cars. Now that is what happened.
After CBS News video showed what really happened when she landed and greeted officials, Senator Clinton maintained there were risks, but explained to the Philadelphia Daily News why she was seen on the Bosnian tarmac greeting a young child if it was really so dangerous.
I was also told that the greeting ceremony had been moved away from the tarmac, but that there was this 8-year-old girl, and I said, well, I can't rush by her. I've got to at least greet her. So I greeted her, I took her stuff, and I left. Now that's my memory of it.
Good to see you.
Once again, her memory doesn't match our videotape. She and her daughter Chelsea lingered on the tarmac to greet U.S. military officials, took photos. There was the group of 7th graders on the tarmac, too. And then Senator Clinton walked to the armored vehicle where she did eventually duck and enter.
It was one of the highlights of President Clinton's first term, passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, also known as NAFTA. Critics blame NAFTA for the loss of manufacturing jobs in industrial states, including Ohio and Pennsylvania. Hillary Clinton helped get NAFTA approved. She held at least five meetings to strategize about how to win congressional approval. She helped the White House block opposition from labor and environmental groups, and she was a featured speaker at a crucial meeting. Participants in that event said, quote, her remarks were totally pro-NAFTA. There was no equivocation for her support for NAFTA at the time.
You know, I have been a critic of NAFTA from the very beginning.
My concerns about NAFTA expressed years ago have been well documented and verified.
I didn't have a public position on it.
I have spoken consistently against NAFTA.
And if you look at what I have been saying, it has been consistent.
I have been consistent.
You can go back and look at from the very beginning.
I was one of the voices in the administration warning about NAFTA.
You said it was good on balance for New York and America in 2004. And now you're in Ohio, and your words are much different, Senator. The record is very clear.
Well, I you don't have all the records, because you can go back and look at what I've said consistently.
Oh, I think that everybody is in favor of free and fair trade, and I think that NAFTA is proving its worth.
I think on balance, NAFTA has been good for New York and America.
Was NAFTA a mistake?
NAFTA was a mistake to the extent that it did not deliver on what we had hoped it would.
Your opponents are saying that that's really part of a larger pattern with you, that you often avoid taking firm positions on controversial issues.
Wow. Just wow. My name is Mike. This is The Hot Seat. Left is never right. Knocking out the New World Order, one libtard at a time.